Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Approximately one child out of every five suffers from some form of dyslexia, a condition that makes learning to read difficult and in some cases seemingly impossible. In this program, we'll talk with Dr. Sally Shaywitz, a neuroscientist and professor of pediatrics at Yale University, and the co-director of the Yale Center for the Study of Learning and Attention. In her recent book, Overcoming Dyslexia, she discusses early diagnosis of dyslexia in young children, older children, and in adults, and what can be done to assist people with dyslexia in learning to read. Overcoming Dyslexia describes how current research, including new brain imaging studies, is uncovering the mechanics underlying this problem and has led to effective treatment for different age groups of people afflicted with dyslexia. When I spoke with Dr. Sally Shaywitz by phone from her home in Connecticut, we began by describing dyslexia.
Many people misunderstand dyslexia. Dyslexia is basically an unexpected difficulty, first in learning to read, and then in having to struggle to read. And by unexpected, I mean that the person seems to have all the factors in place, good intelligence, strong motivation, good schooling, all the factors in place that would say this person should be a good reader, and yet the person struggles to read. And one important thing to keep in mind about dyslexia, you know, sometimes when you say the term dyslexia, people have this vision of a very small group of people who can't read at all. And in truth, dyslexia affects very many people. And it's not that a person can't read, most typically, but most commonly what it is how that person has to work so hard and has to struggle to read. They can do it, but it requires an enormous amount of effort compared to other people who, by the time they're in their middle grades and higher, can read fairly effortlessly.
Are there different kinds of dyslexia or different types that manifest in different ways in a person?
Right. That's also a very good question. Several years ago, actually, our research group carried out what's called a classification study to try to determine if there were different types of dyslexia. And what we found was close to 90% of the cases of dyslexia involved difficulty getting to the sounds of the spoken word. Difficulties in appreciating that spoken words are made up of smaller units of sound called phonemes. And then about 10% of the, and these were children, had difficulties with rapidly recognizing familiar objects. So if you showed them a series of familiar objects and timed how quickly they could say one after another.
You mean non-word objects like an orange or an apple? Or
that's right, exactly. Pictures. That's exactly right. And they would have difficulty with it, and they would also have difficulty if you just showed them letters or numbers, not words, but just letters or numbers. These are the two major groups. The major group, again, almost 90%, has difficulties getting to the sounds of words. And sometimes these are accompanied by other kinds of difficulties. But the getting to the sounds of words is by far and away the predominant type of dyslexia that we see in children and in adults.
So what are the origins of dyslexia? Where does it come from?
Well, up until very recently, I wouldn't have been able to answer that. But now I can give you two answers. One, many, many cases seem to be inherited, so that if a parent or a sibling has dyslexia, there's a very high likelihood, not absolute, but fairly high, that another child in the family will also have reading problems. And in terms of where does it come from, we have always wondered that ourselves, but until very recently, the challenge had been, how do you see the brain in an otherwise healthy child or adult within the last several years, a wonderful new technology called functional brain imaging has become available. It's based on the same principle for any of your listeners who've ever had an MRI. It uses the same scanner and the same principles, but made a little smarter so that a child or an adult can lie in a scanner, look through a prism at a screen in front, and we can project words, and we can ask the child to rhyme these words or to tell us if they rhyme or if they're in the same category. And we could then see which areas of the brain are involved in that activity. And we and other investigators all over the world have now carried out these studies. And what we have observed is that typical readers, whether they're children or adults, engage neural systems on the left side of the brain, one system in the front of the brain and two in the back of the brain. When we carry out the very same studies with children and adults who have reading problems, we see an overactivation of the systems in front of the brain and much, much less activation in the systems in the back of the brain.
Whereas in a normal reader, it would be equal front and back?
Yes, fairly equal. What we do, when I say more and less, it's compared to a normal reader. So a dyslexic reader compared to a typical reader, the dyslexic reader would activate more in the front of the brain. And compared to a typical reader, the dyslexic reader would activate significantly less in the back of the brain. We've become very interested in a specific area in the back of the brain. It's an area right behind the left ear, and it's been named by a French neurologist the word form area. And what's so interesting about this area is that as a result of a study that we carried out involving 144 children, we were able to determine that the better reader a child was, the more fluent the child could read, the more likely they were to activate this area. So it seems that this is the area responsible for what we would refer to as fluent reading, that allows a child or an adult to see a word and instantly read it without working hard. They see the word, they know how to pronounce it, they know how to spell it, they know what it means.
What would happen if the child were to have a tumor in that part of the brain that was a solid mass as opposed to a spider-type malignant tumor?
That would be what we would call acquired alexia. Before we knew about dyslexia, which involves children and is present really from birth, scientists in the 19th century particularly had described adults who had a stroke or a tumor in the back of the brain, and those were adults who might be, 60, 65 years old and who were good readers, and suddenly would report the loss of the ability to read. And that was called alexia, and because it wasn't there from the beginning but came on later, it was called acquired alexia.
So then what you're saying is that dyslexia is something that is inherited, that comes in the genes.
For the most part. Let me explain why I say for the most part. One of the most promising areas of investigation to try to determine what are the genetics of dyslexia has been the study of twins, identical twin pairs compared to fraternal twins. And as you may recall, identical twins have the same genes. And in those pairs, if one child of that pair has dyslexia, there's close to a 70% chance that the other twin will have it. And that's a very, very large percentage. On the other hand, it's not 100%. So that tells us while there's a very strong influence, a genetic influence in dyslexia, it's not 100%. And so there's a significant percentage, about 30%, that reflects other things, perhaps the environment, experiences, different teaching.
But doesn't that seem to contradict some of the identical twin studies? For instance, the boys, one who grew up in Germany and one who grew up in Venezuela, that had extraordinarily similar likes and backgrounds and tastes?
Well, that's the point. I mean, identical twins are built the same. They have the same genetic makeup, so we would expect many, many, many things to be the same. And when something isn't the same, we say, well, in this particular area, and this would be in the area of reading and dyslexia, genes are very important, but other things are also important.
And you attribute those other things to?
Well, we really don't know, but logic would say they could be different experiences, even subtle differences in experiences, environments, or different teachings. Children perhaps were in different classes and experienced different methods and approaches to teaching reading.
Well, let's talk about then the indications of dyslexia in a child. What should a parent note when a child isn't learning to read as quickly as some other child? Is this a problem, or is this just a normal delay?
Oh, this is a really terrific question, because it's important that we identify children early. And in the United States now, most children are not identified until third grade or later. It's important we identify children early because we can actually do something about it. And in my book, Overcoming Dyslexia, I have a whole section devoted to clues that parents and teachers can look for, clues about difficulties and also clues about strengths as early as the preschool period and kindergarten and first grade, second grade and later, and then even in young adults and adults. So if we take a school-age child, a parent can look for difficulties in learning her letters and then learning the sounds of letters and how to sound out words. Another important thing that a parent can do is listen to her child read out loud. You know, then there's no hiding it. And when a parent listens to a child read out loud, she can hear that the child mispronounces words. Her reading is choppy. She may omit words or put in words that don't belong, skip several lines, and read with minimal expression. It indeed is as if the child is reading a foreign language.
But that generally occurs with a child who is maybe in the first or second grade.
Well, that's the interesting part. Even as the children get older, and if you ask them to read grade-appropriate materials, that child will still not read it automatically. That child may hesitate, may pause, may read in a choppy fashion. And as children get older, another important clue is that the child will read slowly. It will take them a very long time. We have now learned on the basis of our brain imaging work that children with dyslexia don't have that automatic fast pathway available to them. They have to take a secondary, more circuitous, I call it a bumpier road. They can read the word, but it takes a lot more time. It's a manual, time-consuming pathway. So children who are dyslexic, as they get older, read slowly. And this would be apparent to a child's parents by the fact that homework would take forever, that assignments may go unfinished, or children might not finish tests or rush through them. Another important clue is the child who says, it's not that I can't read, I just don't like to, or that reading is boring. As the typical child gets older and more mature, and reading becomes automatic, it becomes pleasurable. Children look forward to reading. So when a child says, I don't like to read, or it's boring, my antennae would go up. And a final clue is the fact that another child, a sibling, or a parent had also had reading problems. Now, having stated all these clues, I put in a cautionary word, and that is, any child's entitled to, once in a while, struggle to pronounce a word or skip a word or read slowly. It's when all of these clues occur again and again and again as a cluster or as a pattern. And as I said, I've listed those very explicitly in Overcoming Dyslexia.
I'd like to take a moment and say that this week on Radio Curious, we're talking with Dr. Sally Shaywitz, the author of Overcoming Dyslexia, a new and complete science-based program for reading problems at any level. You are listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Sally, when these indicators show up, what should a parent do?
The parent should act and not wait. And what the parent should do is speak to the child's teacher, relate her concerns, and ask that the child be tested. Schools can carry out this testing free of charge, and that is what the parent should ask for. And again, in Overcoming Dyslexia, I specifically list what an evaluation should consist of, what tests should be used.
What do some of these tests do? Look for an evaluation of the indicators that you've just mentioned?
Well, they look for a quantification of those indicators. So an evaluation would test the child's reading, the child's ability to read real words, and also the child's ability to read what we call nonsense words. Those are made-up words that can be pronounced. And we use those because the child could not have previously seen them, so the child couldn't have memorized them and would actually have to sound out the word. And that's an important key to how well a child could read. We'd want to test the child's reading comprehension, both as the child reads silently, but very importantly, we would want to give the child tests that ask the child to read aloud, where we can measure the child's accuracy, the child's rate of reading, and the child's comprehension. Those are very, very important tests. And we can also give children tests now that test their ability to get at the basic individual sounds of language.
You mentioned, I don't like to read, or reading is boring. In terms of adults, what would that indicate?
Well, that might indicate that this adult might be a bright person who had a reading difficulty but learned to read accurately enough but not fluently, so that reading problem was missed. I've seen so many parents, many of children who are diagnosed, and after a discussion of the nature of the child's reading problem, the parent will say, "Oh my gosh, I've had this. Now I understand. This is what my difficulty has been." Or they'll say, "I am a slow reader." And I become curious when I hear an adult say, "I am a slow reader." And then often if I ask and probe about their early reading history, many, many of the clues to dyslexia are there. The person just was not identified.
So then what can an adult who is a slow reader do?
Well, I think there are wonderful evaluations now for adults, and the history is very, very important in the evaluation of an adult. We would take a very complete history, observe the adult read aloud, and perhaps give the adult some tests as well. The good news is that now there are available programs that can help a person of any age learn to read. The brain is very malleable. You know, sometimes we hear, and it's so frustrating for me, you read in a magazine, "Well, if your child doesn't do this by 3 years, 4 months, it's all over." And that's utter nonsense. The brain is malleable, adaptable, plastic throughout life. That's not to say it doesn't get harder as a person gets older. It does, and it takes more time, more repetition, but it can be done. And I, actually, in Overcoming Dyslexia, have an entire chapter about adults, and I've seen quite a number of adults who've attended wonderful programs where they've learned to read. These programs are time-consuming. They request that the student, the adult student, go anywhere from 2 to 4 evenings a week for 1 to 1.5 hours for each session. And it takes from anywhere from 1 to 3 years. But the difference in a person's life is extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary.
There's some literature of late that indicates that if a person does not learn to speak a specific language or make certain sounds with their throat and mouth by a certain age, that they're never going to be able to do that. How does that blend into a reading ability, if at all?
Well, that's difficult to say. For example, the ability to read very much reflects a child's understanding of spoken language and appreciating that spoken language is made up of smaller parts of sound called phonemes. So that a child who has never spoken, I would have much, much more difficulty in reading, but it wouldn't be impossible at all.
And then how about creative words that seem to flow from people with a dyslexic basis?
Well, that's a wonderful question. We have developed a conceptual model of dyslexia as an encapsulated weakness in getting to the sounds of words and reading individual words, but one that's surrounded by a sea of strengths, strengths in thinking and reasoning and creativity. And it's really quite astonishing the number of people who are dyslexic and who are also extraordinarily creative in the arts, in literature, in business, in law, in medicine, and in science. For example, writers such as John Irving and Wendy Wasserstein and Stephen Cannell and John Grisham are all dyslexic. And so that almost is so surprising to so many people because, as particularly Stephen Cannell has emphasized, writing has nothing to do with dyslexia. People who are dyslexic have terrible problems in spelling, but not in imagining and in being creative. And in fact, in Overcoming Dyslexia, where I list the clues to dyslexia, I also list the strengths, and one of them is being able to think out of the box, being able to find solutions to problems, to see things that other people may not notice, to be able to simplify, to get to the root or the point of a problem. For example, the financier Charles Schwab is dyslexic, and he told me that he had difficulties in reading and with foreign languages in school. He said, but the one thing that he could really do that others couldn't was see the solution to a problem. So creativity can take many forms. In the arts, it's creative expression in art or photography. In literature, it's generation of stories and characters. And in finance, it's solving problems as it is in science. Some of our most gifted scientists and physicians are also dyslexic.
Are there some specific resources beyond your book, national organizations or something that a person could contact if they would want some further information?
Oh, yes, and I list those in my book, but I'll tell them and share them with your listeners now. One important organization is the International Dyslexia Association, and another is the Learning Disability Association of America. And another very helpful source is the Schwab Foundation for Learning.
Is that from Charles Schwab, who
yes,
you mentioned?
Yes, it's the Charles and Helen Schwab Foundation. And Charles Schwab, because he is so caring and has so been concerned about the influence of dyslexia on children and families, has set up with his wife the Charles and Helen Schwab Foundation for Learning. And they really do wonderful work in supporting and assisting parents and teachers and people who are affected by dyslexia.
Sally, how about words that are not like cat and dog, but like laugh or should or neighbor and ate, that are more difficult to perceive for some people?
Right. Those are the words that make the English language so challenging, and they refer to as irregular words or as sight words, and the key about those words is that they can't be sounded out. They don't follow the rules, and they have to be memorized. And in fact, historically, in the late 19th century, when we first became aware of dyslexia, the first report actually was in 1896 by a British physician, W. Pringle Morgan, if parents were concerned about their child's reading, they would be taken to an ophthalmologist. And the ophthalmologists were wonderful. They realized that the problem wasn't in the eyes, but they thought it was a problem of a storage of visual memory, that somehow the brain region responsible for storing the visual image of the words was not functioning properly. And now we know that to learn to read, for most words, not irregular words, but all other words that can be sounded out, the areas involved are part of the language system in the brain. Broca's area in the front of the brain and areas in the back of the brain. But these irregular words, where they're stored, it's still up for debate.
Well, Dr. Sally Shaywitz, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, can you tell us about an interesting book or two that you've read lately?
Oh, yes, I would be very happy to. One is The Emperor of Ocean Park by Stephen Carter. Stephen Carter is a professor at the Yale Law School, and he's written a wonderfully engaging and engrossing mystery that takes place in Elm City, of course, which has no relation to New Haven, which is called the Elm City, and takes place at a law school, which is not Yale Law School, but bears much of a resemblance to it, and also in Ocean Park, which bears a great resemblance to Oak Bluffs in Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts. And Professor Carter has really been able to tell a wonderful tale, crime, a mystery, and to involve all the elements of academic life, urban life, Martha's Vineyard, and I found it thoroughly engaging and quite enjoyable.
Was there another one?
Oh, yes. I'm currently reading Samaritan by Richard Price, which is also a wonderful story. Richard Price has a wonderful, wonderful writing style. He's really able to bring things to life. He writes about a person who grew up in an inner city in New Jersey and who tries to educate some inner city children and the adventures and tragedies, perhaps, that befall him. It's a wonderful, wonderful, beautifully written book.
Well, Dr. Sally Shaywitz, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Sally Shaywitz is the author of Overcoming Dyslexia, published by Knopf. The books she recommends are The Emperor of Ocean Park by Stephen Carter and Samaritan by Richard Price. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious are available for $10 each. I'll give you the address in just a moment. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your cards, letters, suggestions, and ideas for future programs. And here's the address. Radio Curious, Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's U-K-I-A-H, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541, and the email is curious@pacific.net. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Stay curious, be creative, and join us again.